cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, Liz Truss's government has set out the most radical package of tax cuts for the UK since 1972, reducing levies both on worker pay and companies in an effort to boost the long-term potential of the economy. The package is going to cost $161 billion. It's aimed at stimulating the economy, but economists say that measures will add to inflation and debt. Very pleased with us this afternoon to have Philip Aldrich, senior UK economics reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from London. Philip, good to have you with us. Appreciate you staying up late on a Friday to join us on Bloomberg Business Week. Lay out for us exactly what happened and exactly what's in this package and why markets are reacting the way they are.
Yeah, so the big measures was a bunch of tax cuts that we had. So personal tax cuts, there was a surprise cut in the top rate of tax for the wealthiest 1% of earners. We had a cut in the basic rate of income tax. There's also a change in payroll taxes, and employers were given money off in through corporation taxes, and also this national insurance contribution tax cut. There was also a tax cut on property transactions. It was really quite an extraordinary sort of collection of tax cuts, and the idea was to accompany that with some sort of supply side reforms, these regulatory deregulation agenda of the new government, because of course they've only been in power for about 3 weeks.
So what happens in a situation like this? I mean, you know, and not to totally show off my ignorance as an American, but with an understanding of how the British government works, if the Prime Minister says it is so, is it so?
You've got to go. So this will all go through the legislature. So much of this will have to be approved in law. So there will be votes on it. In reality, Liz Truss has got a stonking majority in Parliament. So the Tories will be able to get through everything she wants if they support her. But the problem is a lot of these policies, because they're more of the libertarian wing of the Tory party, and that isn't, you know, the mainstream centrist part of the party. So she may face rebellion amongst her own troops, amongst her own MPs. But, you know, she will mm-hmm. these tax cuts will be voted on, and the regulatory reforms on planning and banking deregulation, they will be voted on. And she's probably going to face more difficulty on the planning and the deregulation stuff than she will on the finance bill, which is the straightforward tax cuts. But, you know, it's been a big, crazy day. The markets have really reacted negatively to this. So, you know, anything's on the table at the moment.
Well, let's talk about what at least George Saravelos of Deutsche Bank thinks should be on the table from the Bank of England. I got this note in my inbox earlier. The subject was what needs to be done. And George Saravelos, he is a currency strategist over at Deutsche Bank. He's calling for a, quote, large inter-meeting rate hike from the Bank of England as soon as next week. I was pretty surprised to see this, Philip. Is there any chance of this actually happening?
I doubt it. I don't think there would be. I mean, if there was, it would basically be a signal that, you know, our policy institutions are panicking. So I think it's unlikely. I mean, he said that George was warning about, you know, a pound collapse a week or two ago, and he was being dismissed. And then, of course, today we had a 3% fall in sterling against the dollar, and that followed a series of other falls, and the pound fell below $1.09 at one point, which is, you know, astonishing. And we, you know, people are now talking about parity with the dollar, which, you know, we came close to that in 1985. You know, in the Plaza Accord, stuff was happening, but the you know, that would be absolutely astonishing if you know, if we hit parity with the dollar. But it doesn't look unfeasible any longer. I don't think there will be an inter rate meeting, emergency rate hike, but you know, anything's possible at the moment. The markets have been digesting this for literally 8 hours, so I think there will be some calmer responses next week.
Mm-hmm. And is there any chance that, you know, the Truss government is looking at the widespread, just, I don't even know what to call it, wildness in markets right now and rethinking at all?
I would be hugely humiliating to have to rethink a policy after just a few hours. Actually, Kwasi Kwarteng, the chancellor who laid all of this stuff out, he did say that, you know, markets will do what they do. We're thinking for the longer term here. So I don't think they were expecting a rout, the kind of massive sell-off that we've seen, you know, sterling being dumped, gilt yields, you know, rising. You know, we're amongst UK government borrowing costs are now amongst that sort of Eurozone periphery, the Portuguese and Spanish government bond yields. So it really doesn't look good at the moment. But the reason why they would reconsider things would be if there is an internal Tory rebellion, and that will not be based on a market reaction. That would be based on a calculation on their own electability in their constituencies, which will, you know, there will be polls about whether these tax cuts for the super rich and not an awful lot for people on the lower incomes, right, and that might not go down particularly well.
Philip Aldrich, really great to have you join us this afternoon. Thank you so much. That's senior UK economics reporter Philip Aldrich joining us on the phone from London.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week magazine, there's a story about social media companies. In fact, more than 70 lawsuits have been filed this year against such social media companies. We're talking about companies like Meta Platforms, the company formerly known as Facebook, Snap, TikTok, which is owned by ByteDance, and Google, which owns YouTube. The lawsuits center on claims from adolescents and young adults who say they've suffered anxiety, depression, eating disorders, and sleeplessness as a result of their addiction to social media. The story, written by Joel Rosenblatt, legal reporter for Bloomberg News. Joel joining us this afternoon on the phone from San Francisco. Joel, good to have you with us. I got to tell you, reading this piece, the anecdotes at the top would make the stomach churn of really anyone about kids who have died by suicide, kids who are addicted to social media. I'm wondering, though, about liability here. Are social media companies reliable for what their users do?
Well, thanks for having me. That's what these suits are going to get at, and we're going to find out. The companies have, for a very long time, I mean decades now, stood behind Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which holds that's a law that says that these companies can't be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by or generated by a third party. So that, you know, the argument being that these companies can't be held responsible for the content of what kids are seeing. So that's the big hurdle. They have a novel argument, these lawsuits do, that's a little bit different from anything that I've seen, and we can talk about that if you want, but that's the big question. That's the big hurdle of liability.
Yeah, talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, well, so what they're doing, what's different about one suit in particular that I write about, is that they're targeting the algorithms that these companies are using. And so instead of saying, oh, this content is what created the problem or created the depression or problems, it's the algorithms that you've designed, that you, Meta, have designed intentionally to hook my kids to your platform.
So it's not the other users who've posted this or interacting with people that way. It's the algorithm, what the algorithm is actually serving to these kids.
Exactly. And the claim is that it's designed intentionally that way, you know, by those companies to keep them hooked and down this kind of spiral or these holes of information that take them to these dark places.
Okay. Well, you make a parallel to cigarettes in here. And I want to bring in Katie Greifeld, my co-anchor here, because in all seriousness, when she had COVID, she came back from COVID and said, you said, Katie, that you had fallen into this TikTok hole and had talked about how well the algorithm got to know you and like served you content that you would just eat up.
It's actually a joke on TikTok when really specific videos go viral. All the comments are to the effect of the algorithm knows me too well. And people joke all the time that I'm so glad that social media wasn't around when I was younger. I have to say, I am so glad that TikTok was not around when I was younger. But Joel, I'm curious to hear about what some of the law professors that you spoke to for this piece are saying in terms of these social media companies' defenses.
Well, it's kind of a split. I mean, mostly you have law professors. Eric Goldman is one in particular who's really expert in this area at Santa Clara University, who points out that the Section 230 defense is just going to be too difficult to get over.
Explain what that is.
Because Section 230 is the Communications Decency Act that we talked a little bit before, which they're just saying we're not responsible for the content. We can't be held liable for the content. We're just a delivery service. You know, we're just giving you the platform, and we can't be held liable as the publisher or speaker of the content that you're seeing. So he's saying that that's, first of all, just a huge problem for these lawsuits. The second problem is that professors point out is that you can't just point to social media as the problem alone. In other words, isolating social media as the cause of depression, anxiety, or even suicide is just too difficult. Mm-hmm. Let's take any number of things, including, say, you know, the fact that the planet is melting. There's all kinds of reasons that kids are suffering from anxiety, and to isolate social media is going to prove difficult, many think.
Well, let's go through some historical parallels here that you touch on in your piece, Joel. If we think about the way that auto manufacturers have been not necessarily held liable, but the public campaigns against them by Ralph Nader, for example, or perhaps the 1990s when it comes to tobacco companies. I mean, I recall those tobacco executives sitting there and testifying in front of Congress. How does that paint some sort of picture about what could happen with social media companies? Or does it? Is that accurate?
Well, I think, again, we kind of come up with we'll see what the courts decide, because there's at least two arguments. One is that, again, these suits are pointing to the algorithm as a kind of, it's almost identifying it as a product. So pointing not to the effects so much, but as this particular product that they've designed that's, you know, to follow the analogy, defective. Mm. So that's, you know, right, that's the kind of logic there. On the other hand, if you say, let's follow the analogy of the tobacco suits, in the tobacco cases, I remember one particular part that was very compelling there was that the tobacco companies were adding ammonia to the tobacco. I don't know if you remember that. And you could point to them knowing that it caused cancer and knowing that this particular chemical reaction would cause addiction and cause cancer. I think a problem there for these lawsuits is that that's a particular health consequence. You know, you could pinpoint cancer as a medical, you know, scientifically a cancer, a disease that's caused by this product. Again, harder to do that with social media, if not impossible. We'll find out.
Are there, you know, just in the last 40 seconds that we have with you, are there any proven health claims that can be tied to social media at this point, the same way that, that we can tie them to cigarettes?
Well, I'm glad that you raised that, because one of the suits that I'm following closely points to the testimony of Francis Haugen, who you may recall testified to Congress about Meta knowing that Instagram was causing all kinds of anxiety with girls in particular around their body image. And so, and they in her testimony was they knew it and perpetuated this and are still using it and profiting from it.
Joel Rosenblatt, legal reporter for Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from San Francisco. Check out his story. It's in the current issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's available now on newsstands and at Bloomberg.com.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Let's turn to crypto now and welcome in Danelle Dixon. She is CEO and Executive Director of the Stellar Development Foundation. It's a nonprofit organization founded in 2014 to support the development and growth of the open source Stellar Network. She joins us on the phone from San Francisco. Danelle, great to have you with us. Just about a week ago, you testified in front of the Senate Agriculture Committee. That hearing specifically was focused on the Digital Commodities Consumer Protection Act that, of course, it's a bill focused on the CFTC's role in regulating the crypto markets. I feel like that's a big question. Which of the acronyms actually has oversight over the crypto market?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me again. Yeah, that is a big question. But I think that what we're going to find is that both of them, and I think you're referring to the SEC and the CFTC, are going to have a role. And I think what we talked about last week with respect to this legislation was that it is really wonderful and empowers the CFTC with the authority that it needs to regulate the spot market for digital commodities. And it provides a lot more clarity to the industry than we previously had. So it's bipartisan, which we love to see. And it's continued reinforcement that crypto is not an issue that's divided by politics and that everyone is invested in it and they have to get this right. So I think we're going to see a lot more clarity if we see bills like this one come through the House and the Senate.
What are the stakes here?
The stakes are pretty high in terms of really what we want to see is a lot more players in the existing financial infrastructure come into the crypto and blockchain space, because it really, like what we focus on is payments and cross-border remittances. We need to see stable coins. We think we need to see other players that are involved in those kinds of payments be participate in this. And I think that it not only gives clarity to the existing ecosystem, but it gives a lot more clarity to others who might want to participate, but they're concerned because of the regulatory environment.
How, I'm trying to think of the word that I want to use, but I mean, how receptive are the lawmakers, specifically at last week's hearing, and other lawmakers that you speak with about the crypto industry? I feel like it's had some real black eyes, especially over the past few months, a lot of high-profile blow-ups. Do you think that's sowed a bit of skepticism or mistrust along some of the potential regulators?
Well, I think, and I think it's a great point to focus on, because I think that any industry that's new, you're going to have like 30 steps forward and then 20 steps back, and you're going to have to climb your way back to the spot that you were before. And I think what we saw over in the early days of the summer with respect to those algorithmic stablecoins and what happened with respect to the market there will really actually change a lot if we can get the focus to create stablecoin legislation that makes it clear about a definition of what stablecoins are, because that's a lot of what we saw. There was a lot of leverage in the market. It had little to do with the infrastructure and more to do with just leverage. So if we see clarity around this, I think that we're going to see more and more lawmakers want to participate here. Right now, and particularly last week, there's so much support within the Senate Ag Committee, because they are truly a bipartisan committee that works together. So we saw a lot of really good conversation and a lot of really good inclusion about this particular the bill itself, but also just the industry. And frankly, I think we're seeing that across the board, even on the House side. So I feel really good, and I think the promise of not just this legislation, but we hear that there's also potentially stablecoin legislation that could be brought together, and I think that could come together also in a bipartisan fashion. So it'll really move the industry forward and create, again, that regulatory clarity. We all need it. One of the things that we hear a lot from the SEC is that the Howey test, which is the one that defines what a security is clear. And frankly, if it was clear, we wouldn't be in a situation right now of trying to gain more clarity. So I think that we all really want to see that happen.
Hey, Danielle, we heard the big bank CEOs testify earlier this week. And one part that stuck out to me was what Jamie Dimon, CEO of JP Morgan Chase, said. He called digital tokens decentralized Ponzi scheme, and even Bitcoin specifically. He had some choice words for it. It kind of sticks with what he said in the past. I'm wondering what you thought of when you heard him say that.
Well, it wasn't new in terms of, again, like as you said, we've heard this in the past. And I think part of the job that we have as industry is to really create a lot of educational materials and to really gain the focus and the attention of folks around the good things that are happening with respect to blockchain and crypto. You know, on Stellar, we see a lot of really big promise and execution. When we see the use of stablecoins in payments, we have a relationship with MoneyGram where you can turn cash into crypto in 420,000 locations globally, and this really reaches the unbanked and the underbanked. And so I think if we really talk about what the good things that are happening in the crypto and blockchain industry, it actually will help move that conversation away to talking about things like Ponzi schemes, because I think that, you know, anytime when you have a new piece of technology, there's going to be a lot of criticism and potential concern of it. And we really need to get to the discussion around use cases, which will kind of obliterate that message.
And Danielle, really quickly, we have about 30 seconds or so, but you've said clarity a few times, and we need clarity. Who needs clarity? Is it just the industry, or is it traditional finance, TradFi as well?
Yeah, no, I love that TradFi. That's another word that we like to hear. I think it's everybody. We all need clarity to bring TradFi in so that we can actually really make this technology work in the way that it should, which is in coordination with traditional finance to really bring to the masses the opportunity that exists with blockchain.
All right, Danielle, we're going to have to leave it there. Danielle Dixon, CEO and Executive Director of the Stellar Development Foundation, joining us this afternoon on the phone from the Bay Area.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stiefel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, it's that time. We are less than 10 minutes away from the close of equity trading here on this Friday afternoon. What a day it's been. What a week it has been. The S&P 500 off of its lows, but still down about 2%. In the S&P 500, energy, by far the worst performing sector, down close to 7%. This after we saw that WTI fell below $80 for the first time since January. Let's get into it, and specifically energy. We do that with Ben Cook, portfolio manager at Hennessy Midstream and Energy Transition Funds. Ben joining us on the phone from Dallas, Texas this afternoon. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you? Thanks for having me, by the way.
Yeah, we're really glad to have you, especially on a day like today, because we definitely want to talk energy. What's going on in the energy market? I mean, is this just flashing recession fear all over?
You know, I think it is. I think, you know, the prospect of monetary tightening around the world is leading to a view that we're going to have to see some slowdown in economic activity or worse, a recession. And I think that's added to fears with China's zero COVID lockdown policy, which has had a material impact on transportation fuel demand in that region of the world. I mean, I think that's all contributing to a narrative that the market may not be as tight as previously thought, but that's leading to fears of further weakness in crude.
And where does that leave you in terms of conviction here? I mean, would you expect a rebound, or how long might this current slump in energy last?
You know, that's a great question. We do have a favorable view of the commodity as we approach the fourth quarter and into next year. And I think the demand fears are front and center, and that's what we're dealing with today. But there are significant issues on the supply side as well that, in our view, will continue to provide some support to the commodity. And you know, those points are several fold. I think, look, you could, if you look at inventories, not just crude oil, but refined products on a global basis, we're below historical seasonal norms. OPEC is continuing to underproduce its targeted quota levels. And, of course, we're seeing good financial discipline here in the United States by our producers, and that's limiting production growth here. On a near-term basis, we'll have the SPR draws come to a close in November. And, of course, we've got embargoes on Russian oil exports into the EU in December and refined product embargoes in February. So on a short-term basis, there's some supply support to be had, I think, on a near-term basis.
Hey, Ben, did the SPR, did tapping the SPR, as President Biden chose to do, did that have an effect on the energy market?
You know, I think it did. I mean, on a month-to-month basis, actually on a week-to-week basis, you know, we were seeing the addition of, you know, upwards of 5 to 6 million barrels and even more some weeks added to the supply here in the U.S., and that certainly put pressure on crude prices. I think once those draws come to a close, once we eliminate that additional incremental barrel from the market, it certainly will add to support to pricing.
And Ben, when I look over the course of this year at a sector level, energy, by far the energy sector, is the winner, still up about 28% for the year. But I remember when that number was closer to 40% year to date. And I would love to hear your perspective on, you know, if you look at energy stocks, specifically the sector, have we seen the high watermark?
You know, for the year, I think going into the fourth quarter, we'll probably be quite volatile as we enter the winter heating demand period. We could see some volatility in commodities, which would lead to volatility in equity values. It's hard to see the commodity retracing back to the previous peak of $100 plus over the next couple of months, given the headwinds we're seeing today. But as I said, you know, there's good reason to believe that support on the supply side for crude and for natural gas, for that matter, which we have a very favorable view on natural gas pricing into next year, that will add some buoyancy and support into pricing. So while we might not retrace back to previous highs, we do feel like there's good reason to believe that there's good outperformance relative to other sectors in the marketplace to come here over the next 12 to 15 months.
So, Ben, what are you doing on a day like today? Are you sitting on your hands, or are you buying?
You know,
or selling?
We're always monitoring commodity price volatility and its impact on equity values as a part of our repeatable investment process in managing the Hennessy Energy Transition Fund. We look at what range of commodity price scenarios and what it might mean for the relative upside and downside in equity values. And for us, and when we look at equity values, particularly, and we're taking the upstream sector in the U.S., we see an imputed price deck of roughly $65 to $70 per barrel implied by the current equity values across much of the upstream sector. So with the commodity on a 2023 basis, the strip there roughly in the $75 to $76 range, we think the equity values are right now, or even though they're down 5, 6, 7%, they're pricing in a much dire scenario than what's currently reflected in the commodity market. So, again, valuation on that basis is attractive. We look at the free cash yields have been very, very strong in the sector, even with a dial down in commodity prices as we've seen over the recent weeks. We still see very attractive free cash yield out of the sector. So on a day like today, we're monitoring the portfolio, but we still believe very strongly in the outlook for the commodity and the financial returns and performance in the stocks.
I should note that the Hennessy Midstream Fund has a year-to-date performance of 22% compared with the S&P 500, which is down about 22%.
Yeah, energy. It's been a pretty good place to hang out. Ben, we only have about 40 seconds left with you, but I know you have some specific names that you're pretty bullish on. What are they?
Yeah, as I mentioned, we like the upstream sector here in the U.S., select integrated companies. We do like Exxon. We think their integrated business model affords flexibility to benefit from a variety of cyclical environments. They've shown some good strength in upstream results, exploration in Guyana and development activity in West Texas. We think they're going to continue to generate very strong financial results and continue to buy back shares. We like Exxon. EOG Resources, another name that we like, U.S. Producer. They've got great acreage in the U.S. lower 48 shale plays and demonstrated an acumen for optimizing production gains and efficiencies, and that's translated to good shareholder return and so forth.
Ben, we unfortunately have to leave it there. Ben, we love having you on the program. Please do come back soon. Ben Cook, Portfolio Manager at Hennessy Midstream and Energy Transition Funds, joining us from Dallas, Texas.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education, by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.